This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Jean Driscoll, who's a world-renowned wheelchair athlete, now working at the University of Illinois as a dean in the College of Applied Health Science. Welcome, Jean.
Hi, thank you.
Good to have you here in the studio. Let's start off by talking about titles. Now, I could call you Dean Driscoll. I could call you Dr. Driscoll. You received, what, 2 honorary doctorates or
yes,
more?
Yes, that's the way to get them.
I often think people have it backwards. Often people say, oh, an honorary doctorate's all right, but it's an earned PhD. That's really what's really worth something. I think it's just the opposite. I mean, anybody can get a PhD if they're persistent, willing to sit in classes and write stuff and just hang in there. But to get an honorary doctorate, you really have to accomplish something.
Well, I would say that both are incredible. I know quite a few people who have started PhD programs and didn't finish them. So I think earning the PhD through research is one remarkable way of getting to be called doctor. But the honorary doctorate is usually because something significant has happened as well. And I've been so blessed in my life, and I still can't believe everything that's happened.
Now, in your wheelchair long-distance racing career, what were the highlights? Of course, you have Olympic medals, you have Paralympic medals, you've won the Boston Marathon for women, is it just for women in wheelchairs or women and
men? Well, it was
men?
The women's division.
Women's division.
Yeah, women's wheelchair division.
And that was like 8 times?
8 times, yep.
Yeah.
Close to 10. I lost once by 2/10 of a second and once by half a second.
Really?
Yes.
And what was your best time?
1 hour, 34 minutes, and 22 seconds.
And that's, again, how many miles?
That's 26.2 miles. I averaged just under 17 miles an hour for the 26 miles. That was a good day.
Boy, I'll say. And which of those accomplishments, won you your first honorary degree, do you think, or was it accumulation?
Oh, I think it was a cumulative effect of many years of being out on the race course and having success. And certainly you don't achieve success alone. There's a lot of people who went into that. My coach, Marty Morse, was a huge part of that. My teammates, both the men and the women, we all worked out together. And there's no way you can become that strong and that fit without having other people who are investing in you. So I've been happy to share those achievements with everybody.
Well, let me get this straight. How many of those 26 miles did your coach push your wheelchair?
Well, he didn't push it, but he was right there in the middle of nowhere with the rest of us.
I want to talk more about training techniques and how a coach does help an athlete from the athlete's perspective. But let's spend a little bit more time on your honorary degrees. Which universities granted you those?
Well, the first time I received an honorary doctorate, it was from the University of Rhode Island. We had an alumna of the University of Illinois. She got her master's degree in kinesiology and was just finishing up physical therapy school at University of Rhode Island. And she nominated me for an honorary degree. And it was accepted. So I went out there, and it was just an incredibly special day. I got to be the commencement speaker. I got to spend time with the PT class and
physical therapy.
Yeah, physical therapy. Yeah, that was fun. And then the second one was the Massachusetts.
Wait, not quite so fast.
Okay.
What did you say in your address when you got to speak? at commencement?
Typically, I talk about how things were tough growing up with a disability. I was born with spina bifida, and it made my legs weak and walking difficult. And then I had a bunch of failed surgeries that required the use of the wheelchair. And I thought the wheelchair was going to make me slide backward in life, but it ended up being the very thing that propelled me forward. And I realized that there are a lot of things, once you've got the right perspective, you can move forward, and there are really no limits. It's a much more involved story than that, but it was a motivational speech. That's the type of speaking I tend to do is motivational.
And you've before you started working full time as a dean in applied health sciences here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, you were traveling around the world, really, giving motivational speeches.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was a professional athlete until 2000. My last games were the Sydney Games. I got the final gold medal given in Sydney before the closing ceremonies. I had won the marathon, and that was a really good way to go out, right on top. And then I was a full-time motivational speaker for about 3.5 years. And then I moved to Indianapolis for about 1.5 years to work in a doctor's office and received a phone call from Sarah Kelly in the College of Applied Health Sciences asking if I might be interested in interviewing for an associate director of development position in the college. And so I came over to Champaign and interviewed, and much to my delight, I was offered the position. And so I moved back to Champaign in February 2006.
And you are a graduate, of course, of the University of Illinois.
Yes, I have 2 degrees from Illinois. My undergraduate degree was, now it's called communication, it was speech communication, and my master's degree was in rehabilitation administration.
I want to talk a little bit about how you came to this university, but let's talk a little bit about spina bifida first. Tell us what the disease is like. Technically, it means an open spine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a disease, actually. It's a congenital birth defect. For some reason, during the first few weeks that I was forming inside my mother, my spine did not form properly. Oh. And because my spine did not form properly, it wasn't able to protect the spinal cord the way it should have, and so there was some damage to my spinal cord when I was born. And there's a lot of different degrees of ability with spina bifida. It depends where on your spinal cord the damage occurs. The closer you get to the brainstem, the less physical function a person has. The farther away you get from the brainstem, the lower on the spinal cord, the more physical function you have despite damage to the spinal cord. So the opening and nerve damage on my spine was in the lower lumbar region, and so I was able to walk. I needed below-the-knee braces, leg braces, but I was able to walk. There's lots of kids with spina bifida whose openings are higher on their back, and it causes nerve damage that doesn't give them the ability to walk. The other thing about spina bifida is that 85% of children born with spina bifida also have hydrocephalus, or water on the brain. And so after they're born, not only are they rushed away to surgery to have their backs closed, but also to have a shunt or a little tube implanted in their head to drain the excess fluid that's collected. I was very fortunate in that I was among the 15% that did not have hydrocephalus.
Wow. And you mentioned some failed surgeries that led to you being in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Well, when I was in eighth grade, I won a brand new 10-speed bike in a readathon that was sponsored by the Multiple Sclerosis Society. And this 10-speed bike was just incredible because the gears made it easier for me to ride the bike uphill and get around. About November of my freshman year in high school, I was coming home from a babysitting job, and I took a corner too sharply. The pedal dug into the cement. I fell on my hip, and my hip dislocated. The reason it dislocated so easily was because of the weak lower body musculature due to the spina bifida. So over the next year, I had 5 major hip operations. I spent the year in a body cast. Doctors were trying to re-angle my hip into the hip socket. They deepened the hip socket. They transferred muscle from other areas to try to keep it in the socket. And then they did a preventive procedure on my right hip so that it wouldn't dislocate. And I got my last body cast off. I went home for a couple of weeks to try to get flexible in my joints. And when I went back to the doctor, he took x-rays and came in the room and put the x-rays in front of that light and said, "I'm really sorry, Gene, none of the surgeries work. Just from sitting up in bed, your hip is dislocating again. So you're going to have to start walking with crutches and using a wheelchair for mobility." And my heart just dropped into my stomach at that point because I had all the same ideas about a wheelchair that many people do. I thought it was going to be limiting. I thought my life was over. I was really angry because the doctor I had was a team doctor for a professional team. And I thought, why could he fix them and he can't fix me? Uh-huh. And I was mad at God for picking on me. It seemed like God was constantly picking on me. And
you'd had enough by then.
I'd had enough, and I could tell him some things my siblings did, you know. Let's share some of this.
And there's a tendency to feel like you are being punished.
Yes, I did feel like I was punished.
You can feel guilt.
Yeah.
Which you don't need at a time like that when you need to be focusing forward.
It's a transition, though. Yeah. And, you know, we have different transitions in life. And at 15 years old, that was a significant transition.
Horrible,
for
yeah.
me. But the great thing is, because of people who came into my life, I went from feeling like I was picked on to knowing that I was picked out. And I was picked out to do incredible things and to have a platform that included giving back and being of service to other people.
Now, when you were 15 and this happened to you, what had been your religious training? Was your family involved in?
I grew up going to church on Sunday. I grew up Catholic, actually. Went to a Catholic grade school. First through eighth grade and started high school at an all-girls Catholic high school.
And that was in Milwaukee?
In Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah. But because of the bike accident and all the hip surgeries, I missed from November of my freshman year until January of my sophomore year of school. When I returned to the high school, the principal said that I was going to need to repeat my sophomore year because I had missed so much school. I had a tutor that was coming to the house 3 days a week, but it was a tutor from the Milwaukee Public School System, and it didn't provide the same sort of training that a college prep school
sure.
Might. And so my sister, who is a year older than me, had already rebelled about being at an all-girls school and had worn my parents down and talked them into letting her go to a public school that was closer to our house. And so when the principal said that I was going to have to repeat the sophomore year, I thought, no, I'm going to that public school too. If my sister can, I am. And I was born a year behind my sister. I'm graduating a year behind my sister. The public school required 8 fewer credit hours to graduate. And so my senior year, while a lot of my friends were doing work study, just coming to school in the morning and then going to work in the afternoon.
Making some money.
I had full class loads, no study halls, and just put my nose to the grindstone. But I got all those credit hours and graduated a year behind my sister.
You caught up. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Gene Driscoll, internationally known wheelchair athlete, marathoner. I will be getting back to her in just a minute. Let me give the phone numbers, though, for listeners who might like to join this conversation. Jean and I are happy to talk with one another here in the studio for your benefit, but if you'd like to join in, we're eager to have you do that. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area, that's within the 217 area code, punch in your phone 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The call letters of the station, of course. If it's long distance, there's a toll-free number you may use, 1-800-222-9455. And that's true anywhere in the continental United States. And, of course, our program is available by podcast, so you can listen at your convenience on a computer or smartphone or all kinds of things these days. Just go to will.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith, put in Jean Driscoll's name, and up will pop this program, and you can hear it. Driscoll is spelled D-R-I-S-C-O-L-L. Jean, she spells J-E-A-N. You can also learn about her by going to her website, jeandriscoll.com. Well, Jean, let's talk a little bit about how you got to the University of Illinois as an undergraduate. You graduated from high school on time. Then what'd
yes.
you do?
I started college at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and I attended for about a year and a half. And
how easy was it to get around that campus in a wheelchair?
It wasn't bad. Okay. It wasn't bad. It's a more modern campus. It's not as old as some other campuses, so I didn't have much difficulty. But I had an old hospital model chair that eventually I replaced for a lighter sports chair, but the campus was fairly accessible.
And were you involved in wheelchair athletics earlier than before you came to Illinois?
Yes. My junior year in high school, when I transferred high schools from the all-girls Catholic high school to the public high school, my junior year, within the first couple of weeks, I met another guy who also had spina bifida and also used a wheelchair. I'd never been in school with somebody else who had a disability before.
Sure.
And he came up to me and said, "Hey, how would you like to try wheelchair soccer?" And I crinkled my face at him. I was like, "Wheelchair soccer? How do you play soccer in a wheelchair? You need your legs to play soccer." And he was telling me it was this really cool adapted sport, and I needed to come and try it out. And I was like, "Adapted? No way. It's not real sport. It's hokey." So he worked on me from September until May of junior year. And finally, to get him off my back, I thought, I will go to one soccer practice. I know I'm not going to like it, but at least I can tell him that I tried it. And when I got to the soccer practice and started seeing what kids were doing, it was nothing like I thought it was going to be. Chairs were crashing and banging and bodies were flying. And I thought, well, this is sport.
What do you use to hit the ball with?
Well, you passed it. It's similar to handball.
Ah.
You could only hold the ball for 3 seconds,
okay.
And then you had to pass it or dribble it. And you played on a basketball court, but you had 6-foot goals on either side of the gym floor. And the goal was to throw the ball into the goal.
And is there a goalie?
There is a goalie, okay. Yes.
How many people per team?
Oh, gosh, no. Boy, that was a long time ago.
You left soccer behind in high school.
I did.
Okay.
I did. So that was 30 years ago, amazingly, when I was playing. I think it was 7 on each side.
Okay.
But there were kids in power chairs playing right along with kids in manual chairs. And the
so
kids
a power chairs with a battery powered.
Right. Uh-huh. And yeah, those kids have, they don't have the physical ability to push a chair. And so they're in a power chair.
Some of those might be almost quadriplegic.
Some were quadriplegics, although there are some quadriplegics who can push a manual chair as well.
Okay.
Again, if the damage to their spinal cord is lower in the cervical area, they do have more function than somebody who damages their spinal cord higher.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Jean Driscoll, who is one of the deans in the College of Applied Health Science here at the University of Illinois. She's in the advancement office,
yes,
and helps raise money for the college for all kinds of wonderful things we'll be hearing about later, such as a Center for Wounded Veterans in Higher Education that's soon to have a groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. And we'll get back to her in just a few minutes about that. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Let's pause for a moment to hear something about Focus coming up here on WILL tomorrow.
I'm Chris Berube. Monday on Focus, AMC's show Mad Men is starting its sixth season. The show has sparked a huge interest in its period setting and has set off about a million internet think pieces. We'll talk with three University of Illinois profs about their new book, Mad Men, Mad World: Sex, Politics, Style, and the 1960s. That's Monday on Focus on WYLL AM 580.
And we're back with our guest, Jean Driscoll, here on Keeping the Faith on AM 580 WILL, heard also at 90.9 FM if you have one of those nice HD radios, and of course available online to be listened to if that's more convenient to you, for you, at will.illinois.edu/AM. And podcasts are available or will be in a day or two of this program for you to listen if you have to miss part of this program live. But we are live today on the 7th of April, 2013. I mention that because many people hear this at later times at their own convenience, and I will be making some announcements of some events that are coming up here in the Champaign-Urbana area. Let me start by mentioning that on Friday, this coming Friday, April 12, at Friday Forum at the University of YMCA, the Reverend Dr. Claire Butterfield will be one of the guests. She is the director of Faith in Place, helping people of faith understand ecology and economy as a moral issue. She'll be joined by Reverend Bob Rasmus, pastor of the St. Matthew Lutheran Church of Urbana. That's at the Friday Forum at the University Y this noon, April 12, a free lecture. You may order food at the Y if you like by calling 337-1500 or simply show up and get food from the a good Thai eatery there. Or you may take your own lunch or simply go and hear the talk. Coming up the following week at Friday Forum, Professor Irfan Ahmad will be talking about local faith-based responses to hunger and health care. Joining him will be Donna Camp from the Wesley United Methodist Church and Foundation Food Pantry. So we'll have a Protestant Christian and a Muslim talking about that issue at the Friday Forum, April 19, at the University YMCA. And then the last Friday Forum of this semester, we're rapidly approaching the end of the semester. Rabbi Rogerio Kuckerman, executive director of the Hillel Jewish Center on campus, the Cohen Center, will be talking at the Y about praying with our legs, the intersection of social justice and spirituality from a Jewish perspective. This is all part of the Y's program on Faith in Action, the spring 2013. Again, all those are free lectures, and they're open to the public. The Y is located at the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street, directly across from Lincoln Hall. Coming up at St. Andrew's Lutheran Campus Center is the last of their Reticus Forum programs on April 9. The same Professor Irfan Ahmad will be speaking, this time on faith and science in the Muslim tradition. And the Reticus Forums are at St. Andrew's Lutheran Campus Center, right across from the Y, on the same corner of Chalmers and Wright Street. They'll be at 7 p.m., and April 9 is when Professor Ahmad is speaking on faith and science. Those are free lectures, and there'll be a question and answer time at the end. Well, let's get back to our guest, Jean Driscoll. So you started wheelchair sports in high school, and then what did you do when you were at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee?
Well, I continued playing sports. In fact, our wheelchair football practices were right on campus at UW-Milwaukee. I continued to do square dancing. I continued to play softball. Milwaukee had a lot of wheelchair sports opportunities, and many of them were through the Division of Recreation in the Milwaukee Public School System. So it was a little bit different setup than in other cities, but I had tremendous opportunities to engage in sport. But Brad Hedrick, who is currently the director of the Division of Disability Resources and Educational Services here at the U of I, at the time was the head men's and women's wheelchair basketball coach. And he came to Milwaukee in 1986 to speak at a wheelchair sports workshop on a Saturday. And his wife is Olympic gold medalist Sharon Hedrick. She was the big name and the most accomplished athlete when I came onto campus. Many people know Sharon Hedrick's name. She was the first woman in a wheelchair to win the women's wheelchair division of the Boston Marathon. She won and broke the world record in the 800-meter women's wheelchair exhibition event at the 84 and 88 Olympic Games on the track, and then for the Paralympic Games won gold medals in basketball. She just is a phenomenal athlete. Well, she was supposed to join Brad to come up to Milwaukee and speak at the sports workshop, and she fell ill and wasn't able to join him, and so it was just Brad, and we listened to his lectures and took part in other activities, and then later in the day, I was playing in a wheelchair exhibition game of wheelchair soccer, and Brad saw my speed. And he came up to me and said, "How would you like to be a member of the University of Illinois women's wheelchair basketball team?" And gave me this whole big spiel. And I listened politely, but I was like, "Illinois? Wisconsin doesn't like Illinois." And the Milwaukee DJs are always on the Chicago DJs and vice versa. There was no way I was going to cross the border into Illinois. But eventually, I decided to take a year off of school, and I was working as a live-in mother's helper. And
where was
Brad,
that?
In the Milwaukee area. It was okay. In a western suburb.
Okay.
And Brad was sending letters and calling me. He was incredibly persistent. Having grown up with my disability, I always wanted to be involved in sport, but my legs weren't strong enough. However, I'm one of five children. I'm the second oldest of five children. And so I grew up being competitive. My parents raised me like they raised all the other kids. I was never given any special consideration, any special favors because I had a disability. I was raised just like the other kids, and it was a huge gift. So competitiveness was in my blood. But I was always the manager or the scorekeeper. I was always on the sidelines. And until I started using a wheelchair and participating in wheelchair sport, I didn't get to get in there and get dirty with everybody else. And so with wheelchair sports, now I had an opportunity to show how strong and fast I could be. And
because your upper body could be developed. And
My upper body was strong from walking on crutches. It was natural strength building.
Uh-huh.
And my body weight was very low, so my strength-to-weight ratio was good. And so I thought, wow, you know, as Brad kept calling and sending those letters, I thought, somebody wants me on their team. I was always the last one picked, and now somebody wants me on their team at a college. So I thought, I'll go down to Illinois. I've got 3 years of college left. I'll finish my undergrad and then hightail it back to Milwaukee. Well, I never hightailed it back to Wisconsin. Because when I came to Champaign...
So you've had to live in a second-rate state ever since.
Well, it comes to find out, my great-grandparents... were in Chicago at the time of the Great Chicago Fire and moved up to northern Wisconsin afterward. Mm-hmm. So I do have some family history in Chicago suburbs. and I remind my siblings of that because they still give me a hard time for living in Illinois, but it's all in fun.
Now, when you came to Illinois, though, you were recruited to play college basketball in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you eventually start adding long-distance track, marathons, things like that?
While I was still in Milwaukee, I had gotten into some of the local 5K races because all of the people with whom I was playing football and tennis and you name the sport, everybody was doing everything. And they're like, oh, Gene, you got to come and do these road races. And there was a guy in Milwaukee who had built a racing chair out of PVC piping. And so
Really light.
Yeah, it was light, but it was challenging, too, the steering. The steering was very challenging. Anyway, so I'd been doing a little bit of road racing, and there was a man named Jim Dersey who owned a sign company in Milwaukee. He was on the board of Easter Seals, and he bought my first racing chair. So I had done some track racing.
How much does that cost?
It was a $2,000 chair.
Wow.
Nothing I could ever afford at that time.
Wow.
I had done some track races, so when I came to Illinois, I did bring my racing chair, but you know, I knew that I was here to play basketball. I got involved in both sports, but I was doing shorter road races. It took my racing coach Marty Morse 2 years to talk me into doing a marathon. But there seems to be a pattern in my life. If you're persistent enough, then I may go along with what you're suggesting. It happened with the kid in high school and trying wheelchair soccer. It happened with Brad Hedrick and moving to Illinois to play wheelchair basketball. And then it happened with my racing coach. He said, Gene, I think you're strong enough to do a marathon. And so to get coach off my back after those 2 years, I said, okay, I will do one marathon. And I started training for the Chicago Marathon. Immediately, I hated the extra distance, the longer time on the road. It was so much harder. I couldn't wait to be done with the marathon so that I could be done with these longer workouts. I loved the 10K road races, the 6.2 mile road races. I even did a half marathon to try to get coach off my back, but he insisted I do a marathon. So in 1989, I did the Chicago Marathon, and I was sitting on the starting line the night before. I couldn't sleep. I was so nervous, and I just didn't think that I was going to make it to the finish line because I'd never gone the entire 26 miles in training. I had done 23 or 24 miles, but I'd never done the whole 26, and I just wasn't sure I was going to get to the finish line. And any of you who ride bikes or run on the farm roads around here in Champaign-Urbana know that there are farm dogs, and some of them are loose, and they like to chase you. So those farm dogs are scary, but I was thinking Chicago-style dogs are going to be even scarier. What happens if there's a loose Chicago-style dog coming after
here
me?
Here comes a junkyard dog.
Exactly. Or what happens if I take a wrong turn and I get lost? All of a sudden, the race is longer than 26.2 miles. So I was really nervous, but I made as my goal that I would try to stay with my teammate, Ann Cody, as long as possible. We trained together, but she creamed me out on the roads. I could stay with her for about 2 miles, and then boom, she was gone. We utilized drafting, just like car racers do and cyclists do.
Where you follow very closely behind,
yes,
yet one or the other. You take turns being in the lead, having the wind hit you, and the other person can rest a little bit.
Yeah, if you're in that draft, there is a significant difference in the amount of work you have to do. In wheelchair racing, there have been wind tunnel tests done, which show up to a 30% difference in the amount of work the person in the front is doing versus the amount of work the person behind is doing.
Wow, how close do you have to be?
Fairly close. I'd say within a front wheel's length.
Okay.
You don't want to be rubbing on their chair.
Sure.
Or bumping them, but you do need to be fairly close. It's, you know, it's like people who drive within a certain distance behind a semi to save gas.
Sure.
You know?
Which truckers hate because they can't see you.
Yes, yes. So anyway, I would stay in Ann's draft for about 2 miles, and then she just was too strong, and she'd be gone. So I'm on the starting line of the Chicago Marathon, and my goal is to stick with Ann as long as possible, and maybe longer than 2 miles. And I ended up staying with her for 20 miles. there were three of us in the drafting pack, and we were all taking turns at the front and being in the draft. And then the other two got away from me, but I was ecstatic that I had stayed with them
20 miles.
For 20 wow. miles. So I only had 6.2 miles left, and I kept telling myself, all we have left is 10K. I like 10K. I love 10Ks. I can do 10K. But it was really painful. I had blisters on my hands, and they had started bleeding. And
now
I was
you wear
bleeding.
Gloves?
Yeah, you wear gloves on your hands, and they were bleeding through the gloves. And finally, you know, you're going along Lakeshore Drive, and it was a headwind that whole last 10K. Finally, it came across the finish line. I was never more relieved in my life. And my coach comes up to me. He said, Gene, do you realize what you just did? I said, Marty, I ran a sub-2-hour marathon. I was 8 seconds under 2 hours. He said, yeah, and you qualified to do the Boston Marathon. And I just looked at him stunned. I was like, I am not doing
You're
another
crazy,
marathon.
Man.
Exactly. Yeah. No. You know, I showed him my bleeding hands, yeah. And I, you know, I was certain it was going to take the rest of my life to recover, but... when coaches strongly suggest something, you end up going along with it. So the following spring, in April of 1990, our women's wheelchair basketball team won the national championship. We had beaten Minnesota, who had been the perennial champions. It was so exciting. And 10 days later, I was in Boston for my first Boston Marathon.
Now there are hills.
There are hills. And if you think about the life of a student in April, you've got the final papers before the final papers, the final exams before the final exams. It's an incredibly busy end-of-the-year time. I really did not want to be in Boston.
Now, didn't your coaches put you in easy courses where the professors would like you athletes and give you easy A's?
No. It wasn't like that at all. It was... just like any student athlete on campus, you know, you are held responsible for the work and you get to lectures when you can. And you when you're not there, you get notes from other people. And these days, the college experience is much different because I know there's a lot of online work that and who knows, maybe there's podcasts for the students of the lectures as well. But back in the late 80s and early 90s, it was we were still attending school the old fashioned way.
And you were getting a degree in communications.
Yes. Yes.
And that's not an easy course of study.
I thought I was going to get into public relations. Uh-huh. I was very shy. I was a very behind-the-scenes person. And then I got into sports as a University of Illinois athlete. And going out to Boston, you know, coming to the University of Illinois actually changed my life. And, you know, I still get emotional when I talk about that in my speeches because when I came down here, I still didn't have much self-confidence and I really didn't understand what spina bifida was. And I didn't know that there were things in life that I could do that I never dreamed about doing before. I was surviving and getting by and these coaches saw something in me I didn't see in myself and they cared too much to let me stay where I was and they kept pulling me out of my comfort zone. And so the marathon distance was like that. And so now I'm out at Boston.
Wait just a minute. Coaches and athletes, this week we've just seen a bad example of a coach relationship with athletes where this basketball coach was
abusive.
Cussing them out and abusive and throwing basketballs at people.
Yeah.
So how do you draw the line? How do you know when you're being abused and when you're being encouraged? What's the line?
Well, I think that's the human experience. If something is tearing you down and making you question yourself and not building you up, not helping you become stronger, not helping you see a vision, not helping you work toward goals. If it's making you go in the other direction, you know, and somebody is hitting you and kicking you and throwing balls at you. I mean, to me, that's pretty obvious evidence that it's abuse.
And you never saw that in your career?
Never experienced that in my athletic career.
Even though coaches get much more money if they have winners.
Well, and my coaches did have winners, but they were teachers.
Uh-huh.
Brad Hedrick and Marty Morse were the two most influential teachers in my life at that time, and I loved my speech communication classes. I did very well in that major. I really enjoyed the faculty that I had an opportunity to interact with and learn from. But on the athletic side, Brad and Marty were influential leaders that, as I said earlier, they pulled you out of your comfort zone and cared enough and saw too much to allow you to stay where you were and helped build you toward a whole nother level.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith with Jean Driscoll, and I promise we'll get to her story about her first Boston Marathon in just a moment. But we are about 20 minutes before the end of our program. The time is just flying by. But let me give the phone numbers one more time. If listeners would like to ask a question or make a comment, share their experience with these kind of challenges that Jean has faced and overcome in her life, do call us. 217-333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area in Illinois. If it's long distance, Indiana, Wisconsin, wherever you're hearing this, even if you're listening online, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. Let me just mention the next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with a representative from UNESCO, the Center for Global Citizenship, Guy Jochen, who will be speaking here at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, April 14. He will be our guest, along with Barbara Ford from the University of Illinois. On April 21, our guest will be Peter Wallace, who is the host for the National radio program Day One that features wonderful preachers from many different Christian traditions. April 28, our guest will be Chester Alwis. Chad Alwis will be directing Handel's Judas Maccabeus here in Champaign-Urbana, and he will be our guest on April 28. May 5th, our guest will be Julie Byler, director of the Chorale that's having a concert on May 12, and the soloist Elizabeth Treat from New York. We'll be talking with her by phone. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. Jean, finally, tell us what happened when you got to Boston after you've had that horrible experience in the Chicago Marathon, and you were convinced you never wanted to go on another one, and here you are.
Yes. There were several athletes, wheelchair athletes from the University of Illinois in Boston that year, and we loaded into a 15-passenger van and did a course drive-through. And the first part of the race is mostly downhill, and I thought, wow, the wheelchair division is going to love this. Gravity is going to do its thing. But the second half of the course is predominantly uphill, and I thought, oh, my gosh, what am I doing? We haven't prepared for this. Now, I wasn't thinking about the weightlifting we had done 3 to 4 times a week. I wasn't applying all of the mileage that we had done, 120 to 150 miles a week we were doing in our chairs. We would go out to the overpasses. You know, we don't have long hills in this area, but you can go out to the overpasses, and Marty would have us go up and over, turn around without a break, up and over, turn around without a break, up and over, do that 8 times without a break. Or we would do time trials into the unrelenting headwind. So you do a 5K into a 25-mile-an-hour headwind, turn around, that's your break, the tailwind to get back to your initial starting point, and then turn around and do another 5K into the headwind. So I wasn't thinking about all of that resistance training. All I was seeing were the big, long hills. And so I was sitting on the starting line of my first Boston Marathon, yelling at Marty under my breath. It's like, Marty, I can't believe I let you talk me into this. I don't belong in this race. We haven't done the hill training. I should have come out here at least after the basketball nationals, but I couldn't because of classes. And oh, my gosh, I didn't think I was going to finish Chicago, but that was a flatter course. There's no way I'm going to get through this. And so the race starts, and I get focused. And again, my goal is to stay with Ann as long as possible. And within the first couple miles, there's a drafting pack of 3 of us who break away. It's Ann Cody. It's a girl from Denmark, Connie Hansen, and myself. And at mile 9, my teammate Ann breaks away, And so she's gone, and it's just the girl from Denmark and I, Connie and I, and we're trading back and forth. Well, Anne and I had a strategy. If one of us broke away, the other one was going to slow the pace down so that they could get away. We wanted an Illinois person to win. And by now, I'm an Illinois person.
Yeah.
And
how old were you?
It was my senior year in college.
Okay.
23. I think I was 23.
Okay.
The girl from Denmark was really getting upset with me because I wasn't pushing harder to try to catch up to Anne. And so she was pushing as hard as she could, and I was sitting in her draft. But then when it was my turn to go to the front, I was slowing the pace down. But I let Anne get a big lead. So at mile 17.
And you were in second and third place?
Yeah, it was very exciting. We get to mile 17 by a firehouse, and you take a right-hand turn. It's the steepest hill on the course. Heartbreak Hill is the longest, miles 19 to 21, but this hill at mile 17 was the steepest, and I was just digging in, trying to get up that hill, and you're going like 3 miles an hour, and your muscles are screaming, and so I had been up front for a while, and I said, okay, Connie, it's your turn to come up to the front, and I didn't hear anything, and I said, Connie, come up to the front. It's your turn. And I looked back, and she'd fallen back by about 30 meters. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm in second place. All of a sudden, you get this adrenaline boost. And I was pumping as hard as I could up and over the other side. Connie had been out-coasting me on the downhill. So not only did I push up the hill, I pushed down the other side. And so little by little, I got away from her. But then I noticed, little by little, I was catching up to Anne. And I thought, wow, I wonder if Anne looked back and saw I broke away. And now she's waiting so we can work together.
Draft, yeah.
At mile 20, I caught up to Anne. I didn't realize it was in the middle of Heartbreak Hill. And so I came up behind her and I said, Anne, I'm with you. And she said, why don't you come up and take a pull? And I'm thinking, well, that's hardly fair. I just chased her down. I'm tired. I'd like a rest, too. But we were setting her up to win. She was the stronger athlete. So I came up to the front, and I pulled. And I was up there for a much longer time than usual. I mean, when we were training together, each of us would take turns pulling for a minute and then being in the draft for a minute. And now I'd been up front about 2 minutes. And I said, Anne, can you come up and take a pull? I'm tired. And I didn't hear anything. I said, just a 30-second break. I know we're setting you up to win. I'm tired and I need some help. And I didn't hear anything. And I looked back and she had fallen back by about 50 meters. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm in first place. Again, another adrenaline rush and pushed up and over the next hill. And I have a little cyclocomputer on my chair, just like cyclists have. It told me miles per hour, average speed, max speed, time, distance. And I started calculating in my head that I was under the world record pace, which Connie Hansen had set the year before. So I checked it at mile 24, mile 25, mile 26. You've only got a quarter mile left. And when I came across the finish line of my first Boston Marathon, not only did I win, but I broke the world record by almost 7 minutes.
Wow.
So my coach saw something in me I didn't see, and boy, am I glad to this day that he pulled me out of my comfort zone. Huh. And the cool thing is I won $25,000, so I wasn't mad at him anymore.
So you were a college athlete, but at this point you were able to take prizes. And receive money.
Well, the wheelchair sports programs do not fall under the NC2A,
okay.
And that's why we can accept the money.
I see. We have a caller on line number one. You're on the air with our guest today, Gene Driscoll. Go ahead.
Hi, Jay. My name is Drew, and I just want to say that I was with Wild Thing Cycling, and there was a time that you were meeting some cross-the-country person that was going to be doing work for, like, raising money for cancer awareness. And we kind of, Wild Thing Cycling, kind of went out and met you out in Mahomet, and we cycled back in with this person that was going cross-country. But I just wanted to say it was an inspiring moment there. But I also wanted to mention that having been a competitive athlete like you, more individual, less coached, I'm really curious about how you stay motivated over the years to have done so many things. I was competitive for almost 10 years, but there was definitely a flattening and just completely burned out like around 2003. And it took us several years to kind of come back. I've never really bounced back to even close to where I was competitively. But I'm very interested in hearing about how you stay motivated, or if you've just kind of moved on to like more of an ambassador for the sport or anything. But I'm very interested in your viewpoint. I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, Drew, thanks for calling. I had a fire inside that I think was stoked over and over and over again as a child being pushed to the sidelines. And as I mentioned earlier, I was one of five kids, very competitive, held to the same standard as all the other kids. Yet when I got outside of our home, I was constantly patronized, teased, belittled, and it just built this fire inside. And so I think when I finally got to the University of Illinois and the coaches were focusing on my strengths and building those strengths, the weaknesses fell into the distance, and that was my fire, and it was my fire for many years. But I can tell you, Drew, I did reach a point after the games in Sydney where I didn't have that fire anymore, and I knew it was time to move on.
How old were you then?
Oh, I think I was 33 or 34 maybe.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And that's the time many professional athletes realize, hey, it's not going to be uphill. I'm not going to be getting better every year like I have perhaps up till then.
I think I could have continued to be competitive for a few more years, but it's such a focused lifestyle. You're training 3 to 5 hours a day, 6 days a week. I had done that for 14 seasons, and my head was starting to notice other things. I'd missed a lot of family reunions, a lot of weddings, a lot of vacations, a lot of friends going out and doing things, and I was wanting to start experiencing other parts of life, and so I think that all was part of not feeling that fire anymore.
And an athlete has to be watching their diet. They have to be eating just the right sorts of things and not any of those sort of pleasurable things often. You're probably not drinking alcohol. You're probably not
drinking
the social
as much
life.
Alcohol as everybody else.
Yeah.
When I graduated, I got teased a lot because I did not know where the campus bars were. People would talk about C.O. Daniels and Cam's. I had no clue where they were. But, you know, every once in a while you'd have a piece of cake or, you know, but you did it in – you were very careful about what you put into your engine because you wanted it to be as strong and pure as possible.
Now, Drew was asking about sort of being burned out. Mm-hmm. Your competitive fire was still there for all those years.
There was a fire. Until, like I said, until I got to that same point Drew did. There was just such a strong fire in me. I loved training. In fact, I loved the training more than the racing, quite honestly, because you could have a bad day and the whole world wouldn't know. But when you're competing and you have a bad day, that's what's gets written in the newspapers.
This is fascinating information about your athletic career, but we do have to spend some time talking about applied health science. Now you're a dean in that school. You work for the advancement department. Tell us what you do.
I'm the assistant dean for advancement. Dean Tanya Gallagher is the dean of the college. It is a college that has several departments, kinesiology and community health, recreation, sport, and tourism. There's an interdisciplinary health program, speech and hearing science, and then we have all of the services for students with disabilities. It's the service unit of the college. And my role, I'm the chief advancement officer, so I'm in charge of all of the fundraising and alumni relations for the college. And one of our big projects right now is the Center for Wounded Veterans in Higher Education that some folks may have been reading about. And we're going to be doing a groundbreaking for that center on May 8th on Nevada Street.
Where on Nevada Street will this building be built?
Well, the address is going to be 908 West Nevada. Currently, it's a lot. It's an empty lot. There was an old student building there that was torn down in December. And so now it's a dirt lot, but we're going to get going on it.
And what will be included in this new building, the Center for Wounded Veterans?
The Center for Wounded Veterans in Higher Education is our opportunity to serve the men and women who have served us. There's going to be a residential and non-residential components. The residential component will be modeled after a program we already have on campus called our Beckwith Residential Student Services Program. It is for those students who have the most severe disabilities, and by severe, I mean those who need personal assistance to help them shower and get dressed because of the nature of their disabilities. They learn how to hire and fire their own personal assistants. They learn about adaptive technologies, and it empowers them to, despite the fact they need a personal assistant, to become independent. Our goal is for them to move out of Beckwith the Beckwith program is in Nugent Hall, and one of our measures of success is when they move into an apartment with friends or into a home. Similar to that, our Center for Wounded Veterans in Higher Education is going to provide a residential program for the most severely wounded men and women who are coming back with pervasive injuries that require the use of a personal assistant. And so just like the kids in our Beckwith program, I should say the students in our Beckwith program, I'm twice their age now, yeah. I guess I can call them kids. But they're going to learn how to hire and fire their own personal assistants. They're going to learn adaptive technologies. Our goal is to help them reintegrate into the community. The non-residential part of it will be services for both for any student veteran with a documented injury. There's going to be an on-site benefits coordinator. There's going to be counseling services. There's going to be therapy if they need it, speech-language pathology, physical therapy, occupational therapy. But whether or not a wounded veteran is living at the Center for Wounded Veterans, they will have access to all of those services.
We're just about out of time, Jean Driscoll, but how much money has been raised so far by you and the college for this center?
We've raised close to $11 million. The facility is a $12 million facility. And then we have a program endowment that we're working on. We need to raise $8 to $10 million for the program endowment.
So you're getting close.
We are with the facility.
Facility.
Yes. Yes,
about
we are.
About another eight to 10.
Yes. Yes, for the program.
Now, if people want information about this, how may they get it?
They can go to the college website. Actually, there's a specific website, woundedvetcenter.ahs.edu.
All right, or they may call you at what phone number?
333-2131.
And that's in the 217 area code. I'm Steve Shoemaker. I'd like to thank our guest today, Jean Driscoll, for talking with us about her phenomenal career as an athlete and now her career as an advancement officer, chief advancement officer for the College of Applied Health Sciences here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Next week, we'll be interviewing on Keeping the Faith, live here in our studio, Guy Djorkin from UNESCO Center for Global Citizenship, along with Barbara Ford from the University of Illinois. The following week, Peter Wallace will be here April 21st, talking with us by phone about the Day One program of outstanding Christian preachers. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
This is Vic DiGeronimo. I've had listeners ask me over the years, where do you find all those great selections that you play on Classic Mornings, thanks to the generous support of listeners? Join me each weekday morning as we enjoy classical music from that most impressive library. You may not get to hear it anywhere else. Classic Mornings, Monday through Friday from 9 to noon on FM 90.9.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.